An amendment of his staff. 8049, 80412, and 80507. They have as the presenters Judge Lina Weber, Judge Sankovitz, Attorney Gleisner, and Attorney South. And the other appearances I have noted are Mark Foley, who sent a written communication, Timothy Edwards, who was on that list, I believe, on written communication, and Bruce Olson, who did a written communication. Are there any other persons present who wish to appear? Not speaking now doesn't stop you from speaking later. I will ask again, but it's always good for the court to know how many are prepared or coming up to speak anyway. So we will start with, unless the presenters have a different order, I will start with Judge Lina Weber. Is that your order, sir?
Thank you. Good morning, members of the court, counsel. If you permit me about 4 minutes of introduction, I will quickly yield the podium to our other presenters who have decidedly more expertise in the field.
You don't want us to ask any questions, in other words.
Right. And I also want to point out that it probably will be principally Justice Sankovitz presenting for us, with some assistance probably from Attorney Gleisner if we get
all right, that. I'll hold my questions.
Not yet, I'd say. Not yet.
Okay. Judge, proceed, please. Thank you.
On behalf of the Wisconsin Judicial Council, it is my privilege and honor as chair of the council's Evidence and Civil Procedure Committee, which developed the recommended rules, to open the Judicial Council's presentation in support of this petition concerning discovery of electronically stored information. The hearing today is the culmination of several years of work by the Judicial Council concerning what some call e-discovery. The petition before the court is the product of careful study by many on the council and by the members of the Evidence and Civil Procedure Committee, including its ad hoc members appointed to the committee exclusively to obtain the benefit of their expertise. Interest in the issues presented by the explosive growth of electronically stored information and its impact on matters before our courts dates back at least as far as Chief Justice Abrahamson's concurring opinion N. Ray John Doe proceeding, 2004, Wisconsin 65, when she noted that preservation and production of electronic information is one of the leading issues facing not only corporate America, but also government. The Wisconsin Judicial Council, pursuant to its statutory charge, took up this issue under the leadership of Judicial Council Chair Marla Stevens and assigned it to the Evidence and Civil Procedure Committee, then chaired by Wood County Circuit Court Judge James Mason, who left the council and the committee when his term was up, hopeful that this work would go forward to its completion as soon as possible. Our ability to move this project forward to this point was tremendously enhanced by the restoration of staff and funding for the Judicial Council a couple of years ago, thanks in no small part to our Supreme Court Judicial Council members during those times, Justices Ann Walsh Bradley and David Prosser. The Judicial Council in this work has been particularly well served by our staff attorney, April Southwick, whose research and drafting skills have been made apparent to all. She has worked tirelessly on this project, and without her help, it would have been much more difficult to bring this petition to the point where the court can finally address this significant issue. Finally, allow me to publicly thank the ad hoc members of the Evidence and Civil Procedures Committee who agreed to serve so that the Judicial Council and now the court could benefit from their expertise in this field. The three ad hoc members for this project are Judge Richard Sankovitz, Milwaukee County Circuit Court, Professor Jay Grenig, Marquette Law School, Attorney William Gleisner, co-author with Professor Grenig of an important treatise on this subject, and Assistant AG Richard Moriarty. Judge Sankovitz and Attorney Gleisner will be our principal presenters today. Judge Sankovitz's interest in economic discovery, in electronic discovery, was triggered by an invitation in 2004 to a Sedona Conference presentation to federal magistrate judges in Chicago, which was attended by several Wisconsin Circuit Court judges. He has taught the subject of electronic discovery at the Civil Law Seminar and in several CLE presentations at Marquette Law School. He has presided over two cases in which electronic discovery issues needed deciding. Judge Sankovitz provided me with my introduction to this subject when he lectured the judges a couple of years ago with a presentation entitled Electronic Discovery for Judges, Old Wine in New Bottles. Attorney Bill Gleisner, along with Professor Jay Grenig, co-authored a 1,400-page treatise entitled E-Discovery and Digital Evidence. The treatise is a nationally recognized resource on electronic litigation. Attorney Gleisner served on the Judicial Council last year and remains an ad hoc member of the Council's Evidence and Civil Procedures Committee. He has extensive training and background in all forms of computerized litigation, electronic document management, and electronic discovery. My role in all of this has been to act as a mother hen, moving the project through a long series of meetings, document drafts, revisions, discussions, and presentations. It has been an easy assignment, given the talent, cooperation, and dedication of all involved. Thank you for this opportunity to provide a little background on the petition now before you. Judge Rick Sankovitz will present the substance of the petition with the assistance of Attorney Gleisner and perhaps Southwick.
Thank you, Judge. Judge Sankovitz. Chief, I just want the record to reflect that I've never thought of Judge Lineweber as a mother hen, so this introduces a new concept into my mind's eye.
Good morning, Justices. I want to start by saying that we're very thankful for the work of Teresa Owens. We've had a lot of communication back and forth between the Judicial Council and the court, working out a lot of the nitty-gritty details of these rule changes. And we think that we've already provided the court with a good deal of the information that will help the court understand where we're coming from and understand what might be the best way to craft these rules. But I'm here today to answer any additional questions that we haven't already answered or to help the court in making a public hearing of this provide an explanation for the changes that we have in mind. With that, I'll invite your questions.
Okay, Judge Sankovitz, first I want to say that I really appreciate, and as does the court, the work that is quite evident in this careful work in a subject that many of us have little understanding, not being born with the computers on our fingertips like our children or grandchildren are. And it's a difficult subject. It's a balancing of various interests and goals. When I wrote, and I'm glad that Judge Lineweber made reference to the John Doe case, because it was the first time I think the court had come up against the issue in a different framework. I thought it really went unnoticed by the bar until I began to see CLE courses that said, hey, you better learn this, see what Chief Justice said. That being said, I also meet every 6 weeks or so with bar leaders, state bar leaders, and starting in 2004, when this came out and the Conference of Chief Justices was interested in, so I was sort of deeply steeped in this issue on a very narrow level. And I kept saying to the bar, any trouble here, any trouble here, do we need anything in Wisconsin? And the answer was always no. We've checked around with practicing lawyers, everything seems to be going well. You know, there are problems in discovery, but nothing big. And your material also indicates that you may be ahead of the curve.
Yes.
So my response or question then, if we agree that this may be ahead of the curve, why do we do this? Are we going to raise more issues or less issues by doing this?
I think it's a good question. Let me start by saying we think that the problem in Wisconsin is modest at this point. And so we have proposed some modest changes to meet that need, and a measured response, in other words. Here's the nature of the modest problem that we have in Wisconsin. There are some cases cropping up in Wisconsin where judges feel the need to have the tools at hand to deal with them, and they naturally look to the federal rules and wonder, why doesn't Wisconsin have similar rules to the federal rules for those modest problems that crop up? And when I say modest, I mean very modest. I've only had a couple cases, although I'm now out of the civil division and back onto a felony assignment. But I regularly poll my fellow judges. I use that information for teaching. And only about every 3 or 4 months does a judge report having had a case like this. So the number of cases is still modest. The problem in those cases, and the problem that we anticipate seeing in other cases, would be the interpretation of Wisconsin rules if there's a distinction between our rules and rules that prevail elsewhere, particularly in federal courts, but also in the other 20 states that have adopted some or all of the federal rules governing electronic discovery. So, for example, if a party in litigation lets its computers operate in the natural way that they do, which naturally delete information every time you turn them on, turn them off, save a document, move to a different function.
Or change information. They change the dates and documents when
Absolutely.
You go in and look at it.
If a party does that and is accused of spoliation because they have changed information about those documents, and there isn't a rule in Wisconsin which gives that party a safe harbor, as there is in the federal rules and in many of these other 20 states, a party might argue that Wisconsin doesn't protect a party in that circumstance and that party can be accused of spoliation. Now, I don't think that argument would get very far with the common sense judges in Wisconsin, but why don't we just stamp that out right now and put in place the rule that solves that problem?
And the rule could be an educational technique for lawyers, because this is going to come up more and more, I think, although it hasn't in the last 6 years, apparently, when the people began to move on this issue. This leads me to another question, which is, maybe this is a mistake, but I would say for the most part you're adopting the federal rule. The kicker in the question is for the most part.
That's right.
Right. So what changes do you make to the federal rules that are so important that you change the federal rules? Now, I recognize that the federal rules are the result of study, a lot of input from a lot of different interests, compromises of people's interests and values, which you have to do, and that different people could make different compromises, and they'd all be valid and all very reasonable. I recognize that. But there's an advantage to having the federal rules and federal interpretations, especially if we have, quote, modest issues in the state. So you can at least look to a large or larger and growing body in the federal system. So what changes are so important? Now, I have a note on this for myself, which I left in my office. Are so important that we have to do them. For example, one change is required that you go meet with the judge versus discretionary.
That's part of the federal rules, but not part of our proposal.
That's right. So that's a change, right? And you don't have the crawlback. As a crawlback, the language is not familiar to me. So those are two changes. What changes have you made that are so, to the federal rules, that are so important that you really think we have to do it? And what changes do you make that are, oh, they're better language, but you don't really care?
Okay, well, let me first talk about that word you use, change. When you first started saying change, I thought, we're not changing the federal rules.
No. You're essentially adopting the federal rules.
What we're trying to do is adopt parts of the federal rules okay. as part of this measured response to the modest problem we
okay.
have. And so we've adopted some and not others.
Okay.
And I think the answer to the question is, why would we not adopt the ones that we have recommended not adopt?
That's part of it. And the other part is, when you've adopted federal rules, you've made some language changes.
Some very modest language changes.
And then what are you willing to give up? Because my sense is, isn't it better to just go with the feds unless the change is important? Got it?
On that point, I think we are in perfect agreement.
Okay.
When you sit down to draft rules to govern lawyers, to govern circuit judges, to govern parties that appear before the court, there's a variety of goals you might make your first goal. Your first goal might be ingenuity. Come up with something that's better than ever we've ever had before. Another goal might be clarity of style or uniformity of style, so that whatever you come up with fits like a glove with everything else that's already on the statute books. Another goal you might have is familiarity. Come up with a rule that's so comfortable for people that they already start obeying it even before they've really had to read it carefully. It's that last goal that governs our changes. We decided not to be ingenious about this and try to do better than the federal rules. There's a lot of ideas out there on how to improve the federal rules, but we decided not to do that. We also decided not to bow to uniformity and clarity and adopt the rules in such a way that they would look like Wisconsin rules and not look like the federal rules. One of the benefits of taking the federal rules as verbatim as possible is that you not only get the federal rule that people are familiar with, you get that whole body of decisional law that supports it and guides parties. Mark Foley in his letter said that there are now thousands of decisions interpreting the electronic discovery amendments that were adopted in 2006. That's a lot of information and knowledge that we can import by adopting the rules as verbatim as possible. So we tried to do that. And in fact, the court has actually suggested in these conversations we've had back and forth of doing even better. So for example, on 80409 sub 1, and 80409 sub 2A and 80408 sub 3, the court actually says, don't just slightly modify our existing federal rule, our existing state rule on those subjects, the subjects of interrogatories and document requests. Let's just take the whole federal rule and put it in place, and we're fine with that. There's a couple places where we have decided not to go and adopt the federal rules perfectly verbatim, and they are minor situations. For example, the federal rules use the word must rather than the word shall. And if you look at our decisions and our tradition in Wisconsin, we make a big difference about the difference about the difference between shall and may, and it's not clear where must falls on that scale. So we said, okay, wherever they say must, we say shall. That's the kind of change that we're talking about with the federal rules. Other than that, though, we're happy to adapt the federal rules. Now, I will say this, and the Judicial Council considered this at a meeting on January 15th. There were some of the proposals that came back to us from the court which suggested that we adopt modified versions of the federal rules, and it's the recommendation of the Judicial Council that the court not do that, that to the extent possible, adopt the federal rules verbatim so that there's no interpretive dispute over whether those federal decisions and those federal protocols have been adopted in Wisconsin.
Okay, so what's missing? What's missing is crawback.
But let me talk about that, then the things we decided not to adopt. Right. And I think the basic ones that we're talking about are the clawback provision. We're talking about the what we call the cost-shifting provisions.
Right.
And those are the two main ones that come to mind right now.
I was going to say counsel, but I mean judge.
That's right.
Perhaps before you get into the bigger issues, I want to follow up on what you were just discussing with the chief. And you mentioned, I think, 80409-1 and
80409-1. Got it.
And okay. Essentially taking, or you said, take the federal rules, and we're fine with that approach.
Which would be 34B1, I guess, would be the federal equivalent.
Help me, or 34, is it A, maybe? I don't know.
It might be A.
Help me with this, then. Because I get the five thing questions that you answered in your letter, in your response. I get that. Some of what I don't quite follow is the need to modify parts of the statute that don't deal with those big issues, the cost shifting, the callback, et cetera. So As I see the proposal on 804.091, and I compare it with the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, they're not the same. So maybe I'm comparing the wrong thing. And then I see the LRB recommends a change from your petition in 804.091. The recommendation includes getting rid of things that are in the parentheses that are illustrative. And as I understand it, Judicial Council has no problem getting rid of the things that are within the parentheses, except you want to retain something.
Well, actually, we're willing to go one step further. The court has proposed, instead of having Wisconsin's 80409 sub 1 language slightly updated to reflect ESI, throw that all out, take Rule 34A and put it in its place.
Okay.
And we're willing to do that.
Just
that's
totally.
Not just a compromise. We think it's a good idea. And okay. Wisconsin lawyers will be guided by the federal rule on that and federal decisions as well.
Good. Then that obviates the need for you to explain the deviation in language from the federal rule because on the petition, because now it's all federal.
Because a lot of
while I'm on that subject, then, let's make it clear. This idea of going one step further than the petition and actually taking the federal rule instead of just trying to gussy up our Wisconsin rules, that's true for 80408 sub 3. That's the interrogatory rule that allows you to provide documents in response to an interrogatory.
80408 sub 3.
Right.
You have a very good working knowledge of this.
You have a better one there because what you have is the table that Teresa and April put together.
No, it's good. You got a copy of it.
If we showed you it, you would know everything we know, so we're not showing.
Reading glasses, though, and I don't have mine. What I would say is skip to the fifth column. The fifth column
one,
is
two.
Where, or is it the fourth column? I can't
fourth
remember.
Fourth column.
The fourth column. We were making fifth column jokes while we were putting that table together. In that final column,
right.
The court proposed on three rules adopting federal language rather than simply updating Wisconsin language, and the Judicial Council agrees.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
On the other hand, you don't really have to change. We can use our shall. That doesn't bother me in changing the federal rules because shall means must, as we generally use it. So it doesn't bother me.
Try to find a case that says that. That's what we struggle with.
But you'll find a case that shall ordinarily means must, but sometimes it means may. And may generally means may, but sometimes it means must. So we can give you cases that say that. I don't think you'd find them very helpful.
But a case where the statutory language in Wisconsin was a must word as opposed to a shall word.
Oh, yeah,
we know that shall means
shall.
Must, but
right.
We know the opposite.
Right. That isn't what I mean by changing
okay.
The federal rules. And you use, there are other languages, and I'll have a hard time finding it, that are reference languages, the reference language that refers to people in a particular way and as parties and et cetera, then we should use the Wisconsin terminology, but that isn't substantive
right.
To me.
And I agree with that.
Okay, so we should change that. It's the other things that might be viewed as substantive.
Well, should we talk about those now?
Pardon me?
Should we talk about those now?
Why not?
Okay. Let's talk about clawback first.
Okay.
I addressed that in that letter that I sent on January 11th. I'm happy just to rest on the letter if we want to save some time, but I'm also happy to summarize our views of that, and we can talk in more detail about it. There's basically three things to understand about the clawback provision. First of all, generally what we're talking about is one party inadvertently discloses privileged material. That rule affirms an arrangement that the parties reach where they say, you can have the information back and it can't be used in this litigation. That rule does not resolve the bigger question. Is it a secret anymore? Is that privileged information? Is that inadvertent disclosure excused? That needs to be resolved by a separate rule. In the federal courts, it was resolved with Rule 502. 502 is not part of our proposal. It is being studied by the Judicial Council. And so our view is, rather than adopt a procedure rule which resolves this evidentiary issue, let's take it head on as an evidentiary issue. And if we can resolve it in a Wisconsin version of 502, great. If a case comes before the court that resolves it, great. As you know from the Harold Sampson Trust case, that's an open issue.
Right.
So we thought, let's not resolve this as a procedural issue. That's one thing to know. The second thing to know is, without a rule, parties still can protect themselves. They can enter these clawback agreements between themselves. Whether or not a court would enforce it, I think, depends more on whether the parties agreed to it than it does with whether or not there is a way to protect a privilege once you've let it out of the let the cat out of the bag. And because it's our view of the landscape that sophisticated parties typically enter these agreements and enter them in ways that are very narrowly tailored to their particular needs, then we don't need a generic solution in the rule. The final thing is that we were persuaded not to adopt a clawback rule because the language of the federal rule is so broad, it doesn't cover just inadvertent disclosure of electronic information. It would also cover an answer in a deposition. If somebody in a deposition inadvertently disclosed a privilege, under the federal rule, you have the right to claw it back. And we think it's way too early for Wisconsin to say that in those low-volume production cases where a client's confidences can be protected, that we're going to let everybody off the hook with a clawback agreement that's part of a response to electronic discovery. In electronic discovery, you have a real issue. High-volume production means you've got to have lawyers look at everything, and that's expensive. And a clawback is a way of saying, you know, it's so expensive, we'll just let the secrets go and we'll figure it out after we get it back. But in low-volume production, which is the case in 90% of civil cases filed in Wisconsin, in auto accident cases, in mortgage foreclosure cases, in contract enforcement cases, in those kinds of cases, we don't have high-volume productions, so we don't have to worry about the clawback situation. So we say, let's put that off to another date when we really face that problem.
The one thing that I thought was interesting in your provisions is that Wisconsin still doesn't have a comparable rule to Rule 26, which is the federal rule of mandatory disclosure. And in those cases that you just referenced, those cases, I happen to like the rule personally because I practiced under it in federal court and I thought it saved a lot of time. In the low volume cases, certainly if there were mandatory disclosures of all the documents the plaintiff relied on and those the defendant relied on and any data, so it would be electronic, it might solve a lot of problems for the parties and for the courts as well. Did the committee discuss perhaps enacting a mandatory disclosure rule to start out this new process that you're on?
We spotted that issue and then quickly retreated.
Why?
Because we were there to try to solve the electronic discovery problem. The mandatory discovery issue is a much larger issue.
Well, you know, it is and it isn't. It involves the management of litigation and the effective process of litigation. I think what the feds put in the electronic discovery in 06, but I was practicing under the mandatory disclosure, so it had to come in around 1992, 1993, something around in there.
It might have even been 1991.
Yeah, so I know it was before I became a judge. So, I think as we look at trying to update our processes that we apply to litigation, it might be worthwhile to try to do it all as a package rather than piecemeal. But the committee didn't seem to think they wanted to get into this at all.
You know, there's two things, I guess, that occur to me in the way that you describe that. One is this the tail or is this the dog? And in ESI, it's definitely the tail. And mandatory discovery is the dog. If we're talking about managing all of discovery and including ESI as a piece of that, we have to have a fairly extensive process to bring all the parties to the table and discuss all these various aspects and figure out how ESI fits in. The second thing that occurs to me is this. I remember practicing before I was appointed in the federal courts in Wisconsin and having mandatory discovery and appreciating it in cases where there was a large volume of documents, large number of witnesses, large number of claims. I've been a judge now for 13 years. I practiced in state courts at the time it became popular, and I've never had anybody complain to me that in a Wisconsin traffic accident case, in a low-speed, soft tissue injury case, that the court's management of the case suffered because there wasn't mandatory disclosure.
Well, I think it depends on what you're looking at. I practice mostly in commercial litigation, and 85% of my practice, discovery was the biggest bill the client got for the whole case, including the trial. So I think it's extremely important, depending on, as Justice Bradley likes to say, what lens you happen to look at.
Exactly. And so we tried to be careful of that. We looked at this with the expertise that Bill Gleisner brings to this and Jay Grenig brings to this, where they do nothing, well, not nothing, but hardly anything but electronic discovery. And so they know all the ins and outs, and they know the very sophisticated protocols that you could put in place. And then we step back with the lens that Judge Lineweber looks through and that I look through in large claims and small claims in Milwaukee, and we see that it's just rare that the problem comes up, and we don't want to burden litigants with procedures that may make it more expensive for them.
I appreciate your perspective. I would suggest, however, that most commercial litigation doesn't come before you. That there is discovery, the clients do pay for it, and whether it's effective and efficient really bears on the people who litigate in Wisconsin, though it may not bear on the courts, because after a certain amount of discovery is done, those are the kind of cases where there is usually not more heat than light, and once the light's on the problem, you can usually get them settled as a lawyer. So I think that this, I'm a bit concerned about our approach being focused on the court's view of the problem, though it's absolutely a very important piece of the puzzle, and I gather we'll hear from some practicing lawyers a little bit later on.
Let me add this one thing then. Like I said, we took this conservative approach, and we decided that we needed to do these things on ESI to show that Wisconsin was not out of step with the nation on that. That's a way of saying mandatory discovery or mandatory disclosure is out there. We just decided not to take it on because we wanted to make as conservative a change as possible at this point to accomplish this incremental change we thought was necessary.
Thank you.
In that regard, Judge Senkovitz, I also attended numerous national meetings of lawyers, mostly lawyers, not judges, who complained, well, plaintiff bar, defense bar, everything in between, who complained about abuses of discovery and the various techniques being used by judges across the country to remedy abuses of discovery. So, of course, I came back to Wisconsin and again brought this up as a topic in as many meetings as I went to, which is way too numerous, as you know. And everybody said, hey, you know, every once in a while you get a discovery problem case, and, you know, there may be issues in any particular case, and they go to the judge. But we don't have, generally, discovery problems. Don't touch it. It ain't broken. And that was not in reference to electronic. It was in reference to
everything. Two thoughts occur to me on that subject, and I'll try to limit it to two thoughts. Justice Ziegler knows, and I think Justice Galeman knows from having gone to the Judicial College, that we teach 4 hours on this subject every Judicial College. Because how a judge manages a discovery dispute is a real reflection of how that judge manages the case as a whole and brings the case to conclusion. So the two things I'll say is this. One reason why some people say it's not a problem is they've given up on judges. You hear that in some of the letters that were filed on this subject. Wisconsin judges are undermanaging discovery issues generally, and they need some more specific mandates from the Supreme Court to get them to roll up their sleeves and manage these electronic discovery disputes. And I would tend to agree that if judges are seen as withdrawn from the issue, if they're seen as the kind of judge who, when presented with a discovery issue, says, a pox on both your houses, and sends them away, then it's no wonder that judges aren't hearing about discovery disputes because nobody's bringing them.
That's the kind of records I've been reading.
Yes. And so to the extent that judges are undermanaging discovery issues, then I think maybe there's some change that need to take place, and I'd submit that's being done as part of judicial education. Because the magic that we try to teach at Judicial College is roll up your sleeves. Get involved in that discovery dispute because, as Justice Rogensack said, that's where you find out where the light is. And once the light gets shown, then the case settles. And that's the judge's job, is to resolve that case. So I think that's something that can be taught. Mandating it by having every party in every case have a meet and confer, and then every judge roll up the sleeves at a scheduling conference and talk about electronic discovery, that's going to impose more burdens than it will yield benefits.
Is there a middle ground? A middle ground saying it's not required in every case, but that in
cases identified as complex cases. I would have said business, but maybe that's not the In Re John Doe was a government case.
Right.
The judge, when looks at the case, makes a decision and does it right away?
I'd say that there is a middle ground. It already exists. It's 802.10 sub 3 sub J. 802.10 sub 3 sub J.
Okay, what does that say?
This is, well, I'll quote it for you. The scheduling order at a scheduling conference may address, quote, the need for adopting special procedures for managing potentially difficult or protracted actions that may involve complex issues, multiple parties, difficult legal questions, or unusual proof problems. That's on the menu of things a judge is to consider at a scheduling conference.
And you're going to add a JM?
And we're going to add one there that highlights electronic discovery, although we could have squeezed it in under this one. So
that's your middle ground.
That's our middle ground. And the middle ground says to the judge, be smart. Get this issue out front. Or, frankly, in this area where the parties tend to be sophisticated, invite them to bring their problems to you.
What about saying that the lawyers in some early documents submitted to the court should label the or characterize the dispute as involving electronically stored information? I mean, something to trigger the judge, right?
You know, we could do that formulaically,
right,
with these labels. You know, our documents already have labels on them. They're required to put a code at the top, which tells us which classification it falls into, and supposedly that triggers different reactions. And you know what our experience has been? In the office, where the new associate has been assigned the job of drafting that complaint, the new associate goes off to a file cabinet, or these days off to the firm's mainframe, and finds a form. So, well, this looks close, I'll use this. And they never change the code. Our CCAP numbers about what our cases are have this built-in discrepancy because people file a traffic accident case using the collection code from the previous complaint that uses a form. So if you have this thing labeled at the top, electronic discovery, and somebody files it, and there is no electronic discovery, which is really the norm in our courts, then you've got everybody looking at this for nothing. And after a while of crying wolf when there's really no wolf to be seen, then the judge will just give up looking at it. So those formalistic responses we don't think work with judges. What we think works with judges is constant education on how you can seize on an opportunity to settle the case. And if you talk to people in the field about electronic discovery, it's a weapon for settling a case. Electronic discovery is so expensive to actually carry out that in a case where one party has a lot of documents and the other party has few, for example, Zubalaki, an individual fired who's taking on a worldwide organization, in a case like that, electronic discovery becomes the lever for settlement. Well, if the parties can use it, so can a smart judge. And a smart judge who's confronted with a case like Justice Rogensack outlines will have it on his or her menu of things at the scheduling conference to ask about, hey, do you have an electronic discovery plan? I hear those are kind of pricey. Have you guys talked settlement?
Can I assume that adopting such a rule will just stimulate judicial education in this area and stimulate continuing legal education?
Having such a rule would stimulate judicial education. It'll also stimulate lawyers to be stimulating the judges. And as we viewed the field, we found those stimuli are already there.
Counselor, if I understand the problems the feds have had, it's basically been the scope of electronic discovery and the cost of electronic discovery. And one of the major tools that they've used is the mandatory conferring of lawyers and then presenting the information to the judge so the judge can assist them at the very beginning of the case. There's no mandatory requirement in what's been submitted to us. And I understand the narration that you just gave in regard to the Chief Justice's questions, but I'm still wondering whether or not we ought not put
something in stronger language than you've suggested?
We could, but I think the one thing you'd have to be very careful to do is to target electronic discovery. Rule 26 requires that meet and confer about discovery in every case, whether it's electronic discovery involved or not, which would mean if you adopted the exact analog and took that language from the federal rule and adopted it in Wisconsin, that would mean you'd have this meet and confer case in a civil case where a hospital sought to have a patient pay a bill of more than $5,000. You'd have to have a meet and confer in every one of those cases.
Now, you may interpret Rule 26 a little differently than it may be interpreted currently. And I wasn't focusing on Rule 26. I was really focusing more on your encouragement of people to get together and to figure out what they're doing, and wondered if that encouragement perhaps shouldn't be stated in stronger terms.
We'd certainly have more of a tool to encourage both judges and lawyers to do this, and I think that would have the effect you're seeking, which is of curbing costs, mm-hmm. if there was a mandate there. The question is, how do you frame the mandate so it gets at this narrow slice of cases and doesn't impose undue burdens on all the rest of the cases where that mandate isn't necessary?
Well, you probably just draft something that could draft around that, I would imagine, if you're really talking about that. I'm not as persuaded as you are that the slice of cases is quite that narrow, but you know, you may be correct.
Well, it could be that we've done a very effective job of shooing everybody away because we don't want to roll up our sleeves and get involved in these things. I mean, I think that's really something we confront as courts. Mm-hmm. Have we done such a good job of encouraging alternative dispute resolution and also trying to discourage discovery disputes that we basically put ourselves out of the business and we're leaving parties to their own means to try to solve their disputes? And maybe our mission as courts is to try to bring those parties back into the courthouse and solve their problems. And to the extent that we don't give judges the tools to do that inside the courthouse, we may have that effect. Having said that, and having recognized that, I have to step back from my own experience. I handled commercial cases. I worked in a big firm. I work in the largest county in the state, and I've presided over some fairly complicated cases. But the 211 of my colleagues around the state don't share exactly the same experience, and I think most of them bristle at the notion of having a mandate from the Supreme Court that they have this kind of very involved discussion with the parties about discovery in a case that's really not discovery intense in the least, and certainly doesn't involve electronic.
Well, discovery. You know, and I agree with you that there are some cases where electronic discovery is not going to play a big part, and I'm not really so persuaded that you can't draft a rule that would be cognizant of that observation. I'm not arguing with you about the observation.
Here's maybe one other approach you can take to it, too, and if we're thinking in really macro terms right now, you can take a market approach to this. There are people in the market who are selling these services. That's why Bruce Olson is here. He will encourage parties to use electronic discovery, and he'll show them how it is cost-effective, and he'll show them the things that they can find out about the other side's evidence that is really instrumental. And a party that wants to use that electronic discovery and wants to make sure that it's well managed has every incentive with a judge who wants to resolve the case to bring it up on their own. And in fact, if you look at Bill Gleisner's treatise, his treatise with Professor Grenig's treatise, and I have to stop and say I'm not getting paid a promotional fee for pushing their treatise. If you look at theirs, you'll see that this is something they encourage lawyers to do. And if you go to a CLE on electronic discovery,
been to lots of them because I'm very interested in
Well, as am I, and I've taught at them. One session that's a kind of a standard fare at these CLEs is, how do you sit down with the judge? Who do you bring? What do you talk about? Definitely sit down with the judge. Bring your computer, and I really don't like this term, but it's the term they use, bring your geek along with you to show the judge that you can be trusted to look in the right places and not overburden the other side and get that judge up to speed soon. It may be that we can count on the parties who are in this slice of cases, whether it's narrow, whether it's 5%, 10%, whatever, that they will bring the judge on board without having a mandate, which, because it's ignored in so many cases, it may be a dead letter.
Perhaps, I'm not sure you can draft language that says which cases the judge must hold a must-have scheduled hearing on between the parties on electronics, but you perhaps can do it in commentary, which appears in the rules but is not adopted by the court, and I'm not sure whether you do that in your commentary, but that may be a compromise.
You could. Here's one other thing that's out there. I don't advocate it, but in the interest of candor, which I think is a duty even if you're not a lawyer appearing before the court and you're just a judge appearing, there are people who say that you should have a meet and confer before you actually serve the request. So you could have a rule that isn't focused on the scheduling conference. You could have a rule that's focused on 80409 or 80408, either one of them, that says that if you're going to request electronic discovery, before you serve the request, you must have a meet and confer, and you must request a hearing from the court. And that would be a way to trigger it that would focus on that. But, you know, if we did that, Wisconsin would be out there all by itself. I'm not aware of another jurisdiction that does that. It's not part of the federal rules. It's not part of the uniform rules. It's not a Sedona Conference principle. And so Wisconsin would be really paving new ground. Now, that's
What's the matter with that?
Well, that's the Wisconsin idea, and it has certain advantages to it. But understand as well that you're going to get cases on it, we'll get cases on it without guidance, and will that additional burden be worth the benefit of requiring the parties to do that? And I think what our experience tells us is, no, the parties who use this are already sophisticated enough, they can bring those problems to the court without having this procedure.
Especially if you think that most records are now kept electronically. It's very broad.
It is very broad, and I think the future tells us that even in very small, confined cases, I mean, it's a fender bender, the person goes for 3 chiropractic visits, and they get their auto repair bill. Even in those cases, even if everything's electronic there, the question is, do we need all of these protocols that we have for electronic discovery to manage the exchange of that bit of information?
What other issues are there? There's clawback, fee shifting, mandatory meet and confer. Those are 3 that are very different from the feds. What are the others that are significantly different?
I think the only other one that we really, you know, we have had a lot of discussion about is the question of appointing special masters. And so
I could
talk about cost shifting now if you'd like, or we could talk about special masters. What's your pleasure?
Let's talk about fee shifting quickly.
Okay. When we talk about cost shifting, there's really 2 different things that are in the federal rules that we decided not to adopt. One is the language of Rule 26B2B, this not reasonably accessible language. That's the phraseology used for saying that certain information isn't easy enough for the responding party to produce. So in a case like that, the requesting party, if it wants it, may have to pay for it. That's mated with comments by the advisory committee, the federal advisory committee, which lists 6 factors that a court should consider before deciding to shift the cost of obtaining that information from the responding party, who ordinarily bears those costs, over to the requesting party, who ordinarily doesn't. We decided not to adopt that language. I think there's 3 things we can say about that. First of all, we perceive the trial judges in Wisconsin already have that authority. In 80401, sub 3A, we have our hallmark. Judges have the right to address and protect parties from discovery requests that cause an undue burden. In fact, those words, undue burden, those are in the federal rule right alongside this reasonable accessibility language. So we think that the hook, so to speak, the legal hook is already there. In addition, we have the authority under 80401, sub 3A, subsection 2, to specify the terms upon which discovery may be had. So we have that authority already to say to the requesting party, this is going to be really expensive, and I don't think you're going to get much benefit out of it, and I don't think the responding party should bear that burden, but if you really want this information, you pay for it. Those are the terms and conditions upon which discovery may be had. So we have the rule already. The second thing we have is some case law. And so in the letter that I submitted, I cited that Vincent and Vincent case. It's a great old case, and I just love it because the numbers are so small. back in 1981 when the Court of Appeals decided that case, it was a daunting proposition for the Ford Motor Company to produce a record of every time that any dealership in the United States had worked on the three parts of the engine that were in issue there. I can't remember exactly what they were. And it would have cost the Ford Motor Company $10,000 to produce all these documents from across the country. But the court perceived that the benefit to the plaintiff of finding that information was only $2,500. And because it found what it called a prohibitive disparity, it shifted the cost to the requesting party. Now, the numbers today, you can add three zeros to all of them. But it's the same concept, and it's already in the law. This is one of the cases I talk about with judges in that presentation, which we call new wine in old bottles. That's what we're talking about with electronic discovery. So we really feel that the information is all, or I should say the tools are already here, and we don't need the cost shifting provisions. In addition, understand that those six factors that the advisory committee adopted are now kind of written in stone. A trial judge in New York came up with those ideas. Without having a rule, without having a mandate, she's a very wise judge, and she's certainly made a name for herself writing decisions about this subject, but that's what a Wisconsin judge could do, and a Wisconsin judge could do it using the same authorities that she used. In other words, all the federal law in this is persuasive authority in our courts, so we already have the tools. Adding this extra language we didn't think was necessary at this point, and in fact we thought it was kind of confining, given the fact that as time goes on, it may be that six of those factors aren't necessary. It may come down to two. And over the course of time, some of those are going to drop out. So we thought, why shackle ourselves to something we don't need, given the tools we have?
All right. What about the special referee?
On the issue of special masters, this is something that is encouraged. We encourage it in judicial education. Lawyers encourage judges to do it, and they're taught in their CLE presentations and in treatises like the Grenig and Gleisner treatise to encourage the judge to appoint a special master. Now, a judge confronted with a complex case, let's say it's complex because there's a technology issue that's difficult for the judge to understand. I'll give you a good example, and this is one that judges will confront in Wisconsin. As time goes on, newer computers replace old computers, and the newer computers can't read the information that's on the old computers. So you have this data on old computers called legacy data. To get that information, you actually got to get one of those computers. What I do when we teach about this is I bring along this 8-track cassette. It was my dad's favorite cassette. It came along with the 1972 Ford LTD Country Squire that we had. It's called the Ford Family of Fine Music. Can't play that thing these days unless you have an 8-track player. So if you're doing discovery about some issue that happened in the 90s, you may not be able to take whatever information they had back then and just pull it up on your laptop. You may have to get a piece of hardware that could read that software that existed in the 90s so you can get the data that's accessible through that software. A judge may have no idea how that's done. A judge confronted with that situation actually has three options, not just one. One option is to appoint a special master under 805.06. A second option is to use that provision in the scheduling order rule, 802.10 sub 3J. This is clearly a place that might where you might call for a special procedure for managing potentially difficult or protracted actions that may involve complex issues. So you might appoint a special master, referee, whatever you want to call, under that provision. Here's a third possibility. The court can appoint an expert witness under 907.06 sub 1. And that expert witness could be the, again, I don't mean to use this nomenclature in a derogatory way, you could appoint the geek who knows how to look at the old software and the old hardware and make it run and guarantee that it's actually getting the information that you want to get.
Who and pays all, for the special master?
And that's a good question. I think there's four protocols that judges are very familiar with applying, and at least the judges who were recent circuit court judges may have done this, but I can represent to you this is regularly done in Wisconsin circuit courts when we are confronted with these problems. The four protocols are these. First of all, don't pick a name out of the air. Talk to the parties, see who they suggest. A judge who's up on the issues may have a name of a person that they're not familiar with. Consider all the possibilities. That's actually required by Federal Rule 53, which is the rule governing special masters in federal courts. It's not mandated by our Wisconsin rule. The second protocol is make sure that the payments, the payment for the expert is allocated in a way that's fair to the parties. What that might mean is that if the parties both benefit equally from the services of that special master, you split the fees equally. It might mean that if one party is going to benefit more, that party pays a greater share. It might have to do with the ability to pay, and I'm certain that's something that the court can take into consideration when necessary. The third protocol is keep in touch. You don't want to create the impression that the circuit judge has abdicated his or her responsibilities to somebody who's not an elected official. So if you appoint a special master, you don't put the case out on your calendar for a year and check in to see what happens. You have regular reports and a regular opportunity to make sure the case is going in the right direction. And finally, that special master doesn't have the last word. That special master prepares a report, which is submitted to the court, not unlike a magistrate judge's recommendation to a district judge in federal court. And the parties have an opportunity to object to the report and to be heard on the report before the court either adopts the report or declines the report or modifies it and accepts it in some modified form. And I can represent to you that those procedures are being followed. In fact, they're taught by two great special masters that we use regularly, Mark Frankel and Mike Skorowski. They've offered themselves as special masters. Skorowski has come to us as judges and taught us how to appoint a special master, how to manage a case with a special master. And lawyers who have complicated cases often turn to them for services. So I think this is a very well-established option for judges to use, which makes it easier for judges to manage electronic discovery disputes.
So it goes to,
Go ahead, Justice Gable.
So it goes to ability to pay for who pays? That's the factor.
I would say that's one factor, but it wouldn't necessarily be a controlling factor. It may be that if a party doesn't have the ability to pay for the special master, that's an indication of their inability to pay for the discovery that they propose or the burden of discovery that they're imposing on another party. And so everything may unravel at that point. On the other hand, I could conceive of a case where a party has a just cause and the court needs the assistance of a special master, and it's not unfair to have one party bear a disproportionate share of the cost based on ability to pay. So it's a factor to consider.
Are there any other questions? Justice Prosser.
What is the relationship between the uniform law and the federal rules? And then after you answer that, what is the relationship between those things and this proposal?
I think that the commissioners who sit on the Uniform Laws Commission have followed the same trajectory, let's say, of the development of electronic discovery management, as did the members of the Federal Advisory Committee that drafted the federal rules. So I think what they have in common is they're both looking at the same problem. And I think they look at each other's work and it's influenced each other. I think you find that the uniform laws tend to have been published after the proposed federal rules. So if you had to say who gets drafting credit, probably the federal drafters get more of the credit than the uniform commissioners. But you'll find a lot of similarities between the two. The benefit of both of those organizations, both the federal courts and the Uniform Laws Commission, is that if there's uniformity, then there's predictability. And that's what lawyers and parties are looking for out of courts. And frankly, that's what trial judges are looking for. You know, we want to make the right call. And if we know that this is the call that's made across a broad spectrum of cases, that gives us confidence. And what I said earlier, and what I'll just briefly repeat, is we think that there's some parts of the federal rules which are echoed in the uniform laws, which will be helpful in Wisconsin, but only some parts. Like I said, an incremental change that's a measured response to a modest problem.
What I'm really trying to get at, as a former uniform law commissioner, there was a general tenet that commissioners were supposed to go back and adopt the uniform law in their respective states.
So that was really the tradition with the Uniform Commercial Code, right?
Exactly. And it was frowned upon to deviate. Now, it seems to me, and maybe I'm wrong here, is that you have the uniform law, you have the federal rules, they're close, but they're not identical. And that, in fact, the proposal is not identical to either one of them. if you were looking at this from the hierarchy of the Uniform Laws Commission, would you say that if we adopted the petition, that we would be adopting the uniform law, or would be not adopting it, or deviating from it, or how do you think they would characterize what is being proposed?
They would say that the whole menu is what Wisconsin should have, so Wisconsin stays in line with everybody else, on the assumption that cases that come before Wisconsin Circuit Courts are like cases that come before courts in other places where those uniform laws have been adopted. But that's where the assumption runs aground, because so few cases in Wisconsin raise these issues, adopting the full menu imposes more burdens on Wisconsin litigants than it yields benefits. So we have, and I think this is the best way to describe it, borrowed some and not all.
I'm kind of curious, and you may not want to talk about this, but I think you said that in your experience you had two cases. Okay. Are you able to recall, if you want to, what the issues were and
vividly, and
how you, what you used to resolve those issues?
Oh, I used the Sedona principles. I don't know if I ever had to cite them. I didn't have to give a written decision. My role in both of those two cases was informal rather than formal. Now, it took place on the record. I was wearing a robe. It was a courtroom. But it wasn't like the parties had filed a motion that required a decision employing the Sedona principles. The party filed a motion. There was a motion to compel in both cases. But that just led to a conversation about the most practical way to solve the problem. And in both cases, it was solved using some very practical techniques that a knowledgeable judge might suggest on his or her own behalf, or a judge who doesn't feel as comfortable might say to the parties, you got yourselves quite a problem there. How about if we have an expert take a look at this? I'll appoint that expert as an expert witness, or I'll refer this to that person as a special master, give you 30 days to work with the master, come back with a report, you get a chance to argue it, and then I'll make a decision. And usually when that gets done, there really is no decision for the court to make. Those special masters help the parties understand you don't want to ask for every one of these documents. You don't want to ask for all this in native form. This will cost you a mint. Here, let's form a search of your documents using these sample words, these sampling words, and that's going to generate a small slice of the documents. And after you get that, you can see whether it's worthwhile looking for and paying the price for looking for all the rest of the documents. And that's what I did in those two cases.
Would you please help me understand exactly what the special master's role is? Is the special master a sort of a facilitator, or is the special master a fact finder?
The special master could be either, depending on what the case needs. And so you have this word reference that's in the statute. The reference is the word reference. When you refer a case to a special master, the thing that's being referred is called a reference. The judge gets to detail what's being referred and what's not. And so you might refer to a special master to say, work with the parties to narrow their sampling of the responding party's data. Now, that's not necessarily a decision that that special master has to make, but the special master carries that out, either says, yeah, I got the parties to agree on a narrower sample, or didn't, and then says to the circuit judge, they can't agree on this, here are the pros and cons, here's my recommendation, it's up to you to make a decision. And then that master's recommendation comes back to the trial court. So a special master could provide both those roles. In my experience, talking to lawyers in this field, a lot of electronic discovery disputes are being resolved practically rather than legally. It doesn't come down to what the judge finally says as a legal matter. It comes down to the fact that if you have an expert involved and the parties are actually talking to each other, they can work out an agreement which works for them, and they go away with their agreement as opposed to a decision from the court. Does that answer the question? Does that help?
When the special master comes back to the court, is that special master subject to examination and cross-examination?
Good question. Let me say that when I answer these questions, I'm talking specifically about electronic discovery right now, but our experience in the circuit courts with the special masters covers the gamut. when a typical case is not an electronic discovery case. A typical case is when the parties have a lot of depositions and they can't get them scheduled and they have a recurring privilege issue or a recurring evidentiary issue, and that special master will be available by telephone to rule on that issue and make a recommendation to the trial judge, for example. Or another example would be the parties have immense numbers of documents and are trying to figure out the most cost-effective way of conveying them from point A to point B, and all the privilege issues that arise in the scope of that. The special master gives the parties a first hearing on that, tries to get them to agree where possible to how they're going to accomplish their task, and the parts that can't be agreed upon, the special master makes a recommendation, which the trial judge then would either affirm or decline or modify after hearing from the parties. In any one of those instances, the work product that comes back before the trial court is typically a written report. And so there's really not a cross-examination issue, because it's not as though the special master is a witness. The special master is more of a report generator, and it's the content of the report that's subject to arguments that necessarily, I don't think cross-examination would be a useful tool. In the old days, there was cross-examination of special masters because the special master actually sat like a judge and looked at account books. In fact, if you look at our 80506, it's mainly about accounting. That's in the old days why we appointed special masters, because judges didn't have the time to look at all the books and didn't have the competence to look at it from an accounting point of view. So you'd have a special master who'd be trying to make all the accounts balance in a company that was the subject of theft or a company that was in receivership. And after doing all that, the accountant, the special master, who is typically an accountant, came up with a report and submitted it. In a case like that, you might want to cross-examine the special master to find out, okay, did you look at this using a FIFO approach or a LIFO approach, or did you look at all these accounts, or did you sample them? And if that wasn't clear in the face of the report, then you might subject the special master to examination. In the electronic discovery field, you're not really fact-finding as much as that. You're looking at facts which are pretty well established and beyond dispute, but you're looking for an opinion or an application of law to fact. That comes in the form of a report, which is subject to argument, not cross-examination.
Real goal is to bring the parties together and have them agree.
Sure.
In a practical way.
And that's, that's sometimes true of so many discovery disputes.
And sometimes you need an outsider.
Sure. You need somebody who's impartial. But the benefit of a special master is you also have somebody who's smart, maybe even smarter than the lawyers, at least on these electronic discovery issues.
Are there any other questions? Do you have anything you would like to add to what we have just said?
Let me just finish where I started, and I'll make it brief. When you talk about changing these rules to address this issue, you could make ingenuity your goal. You could also make style your goal. Our request is that you make familiarity and predictability your goal and adopt those rules which are familiar to lawyers and to parties and to judges and have this decisional law behind them, and adopt those things which you think will benefit our proceedings without causing undue burden on people who don't need electronic discovery in their cases.
I have a final question, and that is, it seems to me that I've heard that at least on some matters that you do not view as critical, that would not critical to you would be drawback, mandatory, meet and confer, course shifting, etc. On those that don't fit within those categories and have a word changes that aren't geared to Wisconsin, I hear that you would be willing to move to what the federal words are.
Correct.
Your reference has been to, discussing this, which we ask Ms. Owens to do, see where issues are and might be, et cetera. But is it necessary to file, I don't want necessarily ask you to file another petition, but to show, other than on her chart, exactly what you're willing to accept or not?
I know that there has been a more or less formal response that's been submitted, and that may be sufficient, but if the court wants more detail or if we think it would benefit the public to have more detail on it, we're happy to do that.
And what do you consider the formal response, your letter?
Well, the memo that at least, let's see.
Just so we had a lot of documents in front of us. Just so I know what exactly.
I have the memo from April Southwick to the Judicial Council dated January 8th. Has that been transmitted to
memo
the court?
Is that part of our packet?
Okay. No, it's not. What April tells me is that there's been a summary of what I have in front of me that has been submitted to the court. What date was that submitted? Okay.
Okay. We'll deal with it. Ms. Southwick is going to testify. But that's so that we have it in one place. We can see the exact words.
Fourth column.
Fourth column. just easier when you have a working familiarity with the rules, but not having drafted them or worked with them intimately, you don't have, as you very well know, the problem.
Believe me, I know that.
I want to thank you personally for all your work, and not only in helping draft all this, but in your educational program for the judges on this issue and on many other issues, Judge. So, and for spending the morning with us to deal with this problem.
Thank you. It's really my pleasure. Thank you.
Attorney Gleister.
Madam Chief Justice, honorable members of the court, Judge Sankovitz has been comprehensive. I just have a few remarks in addition, and I'll be brief. Justice Rogensack raises a very good point, and I think my good friend Mark Foley would attest to the fact that commercial litigation already involves a lot of e-discovery, and sooner or later it's going to find its way into state court. And Justice Prosser raises a good point when he asked Judge Sankovitz about personal experiences with e-discovery. I would like to relate one of my personal experiences in Milwaukee Circuit Court. Last year I was retained as of counsel by a law firm in Milwaukee in a legal malpractice action against a New York City law firm. No diversity of jurisdiction found, so it ended up in Judge Dugan's court in Milwaukee County. The counsel for the New York law firm claimed there were no documents that related to a number of very important issues in the case, and was adamant that they had produced everything that they had. There was nothing else, and that was it. So we brought an e-discovery motion before Judge Dugan. There was a great deal of briefing back and forth, relying mainly on federal authorities. And an argument was made, well, that's fine, but that doesn't really apply. We're in state court. And Judge Dugan came out on the day that he was faced with the responsibility of issuing a decision, and he had researched the federal manual on complex litigation, and that was the only tool he had available to him. He ruled in our favor. We went to New York City. We took a deposition of the IS director for about 8 or 9 hours. I took the deposition. We came up with hundreds of pages of very relevant documents that they had never produced that were in their computer system. And the point is this. I think I look at the adoption of the modest adoption that is proposed as sort of allowing state court judges, when they're confronted with a problem, to go to the federal cabinet and take down the decisional library, or take from the decisional library in the federal level, and help them resolve disputes that are inevitably going to arise as e-discovery becomes more commonplace. And I don't see it as, I think it would be unfortunate if e-discovery became the tail that wagged the dog. So we haven't been very comprehensive, but the council is looking at issues like spoliation. It is looking at issues like cost shifting under Zubelake, and further issues that relate to matters such as Rule 502 on the federal level. I think this is like tailoring a coat, and you put it on, and obviously there'll have to be alterations and changes as time goes by, but at least it will provide the state judiciary with some tools that they can use when confronted with issues. They won't have to go to the Manual for Complex Litigation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Glazer.
Mr. Glazer.
I'm sorry. Counsel.
I thought I understood from Judge Schleinweber's introduction. Are you a member of the Judicial Council, or were you, or what's the story here?
Well, Judge, for 1 year, I was appointed by President-elect Kammer. He has the ability to appoint for 1 year. I was appointed in 2008 and 2009. I enjoyed the work very much, and so I joined Judge Schleinweber's committee after my term ended as an ad hoc member, and I am I'm blessed with the having been nominated to the council again, and we'll see what happens in April, Justice.
You're on the state bar ballot for that.
Yes, yes, Justice, Chief Justice, that's correct.
You've written a book on this subject?
Yes, Justice, I have.
How did you get into that?
Well, I was originally, for many years, general counsel for the National Federation of the Blind, and I went all around the country handling litigation. That sounds like a great title, but I was often the Lone Ranger, and I was often up against federal and state governments and very large law firms. And so early on, back in the 80s and certainly in the 90s, I started using computers to level the playing field. And it just kind of happened after that, Justice.
Now, hold, what's the title of your book?
Yeah, hold up your book.
Discovery of Digital Evidence, Justice.
Is that on the New York Times bestseller list?
Don't think so, Justice. I don't think so.
No sex, no violence?
Some pictures, though, Justice.
Oh, okay. All right.
But after today's hearing, it will be.
Yes, Justice. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
And any additional thoughts that you wanted to? Well, I think one critical question would be this. How urgent is it that we go forward?
Well, Justice, it seems to me this you asked about uniform laws. And while this is growing like Topsy, it's not as well regimented or organized as the uniform effort was for the Uniform Commercial Code. E-discovery is becoming a burning issue in other jurisdictions. And what I think may occur, like occurred to me in this case against the New York law firm, is you will have circumstances where there will be cases in our state courts that deal with defendants from foreign jurisdictions, and it would be nice to equip our state litigators with the ability to be on a level playing field with these out-of-state defendants. And I also think, and Mr. Foley would be able to enlighten you more on this, along the lines of what Justice Rogensack suggested, I think that commercial litigation is already there, so that giving the judges and the judiciary and the bench and bar the ability to access the federal decisional library is not the final word on the subject. There may be need for modifications or changes, but at least it will give the judiciary, the bench and bar, tools that they can access in those, so far, rare circumstances where e-discovery becomes an issue.
Thank you, counsel. Attorney Southwick, representing the Wisconsin Judicial Council.
Good morning. As my counsel and committee members have done such an excellent job addressing the substantive points, I just want to briefly address a procedural matter. And just to clarify, the council is more than happy to work with the court on tweaking specific language if there's items that need to be addressed further. If you wish to, that we file an amended petition, we're more than happy to do that, or we will certainly work with the court and staff to craft some language that is to your liking. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Southwick, and thank you for joining the Judicial Council and working on this petition. Attorney Mark Foley. Mr. Foley, you have submitted a written statement, and we're delighted to see you here today. And the court does have your written statement. It's in our tab 18. You may proceed, counsel.
If I may just very briefly talk a little bit about my background and interest in the area. I have been a Wisconsin licensed civil litigator for 28 years. Until last June, I was, that time was spent at Foley & Lardner. I was a partner at Foley & Lardner in the litigation department. I helped develop their e-discovery training materials. I have spoken and written nationally on the subject. I have been involved with computers and computer issues during almost the entirety of that 28 years. I am now a shareholder at Von Breesen & Roper. I've been there in 6 months, and to address some of the questions that have been asked here today, how important is this? I expected that this practice, which has now shifted more to the local court system than my practice has been traditionally, would see less of these issues. I presently have pending 5 civil litigation cases in Wisconsin circuit courts, all of which have e-discovery issues, every one of them. They are all commercial in nature. They are not traffic cases. They are not product liability cases. I do have a product liability case pending in Dane County Circuit Court, which has not yet, but I fully expect to become a serious e-discovery issue because all of the relevant information is in legacy systems. So I think one of the points I would like to make here today, to echo what Justice Rokensack has said, is that much of this is invisible to the judiciary. It is certainly mostly invisible to the appellate courts of Wisconsin. And the reason is because decisions are being made every day by the lawyers and the litigants that are not brought to the judges. And they're being made on the basis of what is the tail that wags the dog here. And let me tell you, it is wagging the litigation dog very, very hard. And that is the cost of e-discovery. And I would urge the court to think about every conceivable way to draft these rules and to make its decisions that will reduce the cost. Let me just give you some very quick statistics. The latest estimate, this comes out of some studies by the Sedona Conference, which is focused on e-discovery, is that 98% of business information today is created or stored electronically. We are moving toward a society where all medical-related information will be electronic. That means every product liability case, every malpractice case, every personal injury case is going to involve some element of electronic discovery. In my submission, I cited just some very quick statistics from The Economist in 2007. E-discovery may have increased the cost of federal litigation by 25%. Now, that's not because they have rules. It's because the litigation involves e-discovery. Also in 2007, Beltlantic Corporation versus Twombly, United States Supreme Court decision. The threat of discovery expenses could push cost-conscious defendants to settle even anemic cases. Let me tell you, it does every day. The American Conference of Trial Lawyers, e-discovery rulemaking, and they're referring specifically here to the federal and uniform rules, quote, has accomplished little or nothing. This area of the law is a mess. It's a mess on a practical level. Now, I have advocated in my submission that you should, if you're going to make minimal changes, that you should hew as closely to the federal rules as possible. And there are two reasons for that. One is they are, in my opinion, and Judge Prosser, with all due respect to the uniform rules process, they are, in my opinion, much better than the uniform rules. And to the extent that almost no states have adopted the uniform rules, those states who have adopted their own rules have adopted things that look much more like the federal rules than the uniform rules. And in part, the reason for that is, as Mr. Gleisner said, there are thousands of federal cases interpreting and applying and struggling with these rules and the same issues from the period before the rules were adopted. The Zubile case was not based on the federal rules. The federal rules were essentially born out of the Zubile case and others that had tried to come to grips with these rules, and litigants' unhappiness with the balance that the courts were striking. So I've provided some comments about specific wording issues, some internal inconsistencies. These are all minor things which I'm sure the good people on this committee can and will address.
What about the major things? I'm looking at your letter, and you indicate, you know, 802.10 really changed there, just adding the GM doesn't move the ball. Is your position that you want a mandatory meet and discuss?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. And that's in the federal. Is your, what's your position on cost shifting?
I think that that, I think that the cost shifting, clawback, and the privilege rule provisions all need to be adopted, and they need to be adopted at the same time. And if I could just talk, Your Honor, for a moment about the relationship.
And what about the referee, Special Master?
I think that's optional, but I have an alternative suggestion as to how that might be structured.
All right. I'm sorry. You continue.
Okay. If I may, let me just add one more thing by way of background. Mr. Gleisner and I have been co-counsel in cases. I just remembered Mr. Olson and I were adverse in a case when he still had his law office up in Appleton. I was adverse to the judge here before he was a judge. I was adverse to Justice Rogensack when she was in private practice, if I recall correctly, Justice Bradley as well. I hope you won't hold that against me when I appear here for clients. It's always a hard thing to define, Your Honor, but I'm sure it was my client.
You may proceed.
I've also been involved in cases, federal and state, in 25 jurisdictions. So I've seen how they do this in a lot of different places. Let me talk about the privilege rule, because the committee specifically decided not to address that at this time. I know they have another process going forward. But let me explain how that and the clawback rules and the cost shifting all interplay together. Without dealing with all of them, you won't deal with the problem effectively at all. The problem with e-discovery is volume. Yes, you can try keyword searches. Yes, you can do various things to try to reduce the volume of what you're collecting and therefore have to review. But what you end up with is a body of data which has to be reviewed for at least two things. One is privilege, and the other is relevance or responsiveness to the discovery requests. The privilege review effectively requires that every document, and I'm talking about every email being a document in this sense, has to be looked at. I have a case pending right now where I am defending two individuals who used to be officers of a corporation. Corporation is suing them. One of those individuals left with the company's laptop that had his email, business and corporate, interspersed for a 9-year period. There are 60,000 emails on that one machine. The discovery request from the other side is essentially everything that was on the laptop when you left. 60,000 emails. Now, if it's Intergalactic Corp versus Mega International, 60,000 emails is nothing. I've been involved in cases with 10 million records. But for these individual litigants paying their lawyers to look at 60,000 records is an enormous relative cost. So, can the lawyers take the malpractice risk of not reviewing them all? Let's do some keyword searches, let's look for emails directed to law firms or specific lawyers, and we'll be done with that. No, they cannot, because there are decisions all over this country saying it's malpractice. And they hang the lawyers, they impose sanctions on them, and they end up with malpractice claims. Can the client take the risk of losing its attorney-client privilege? Well, in this jurisdiction, I submit that the rule is sometimes interpreted in this way. If I show you one document about a particular subject matter that's privileged, I've now waived the privilege with regard to the entire subject matter. So if I look at those 60,000 documents, and I'm right about 59,999 of them, but one gets through, I may have waived for my client inadvertently the privilege with regard to the entire subject matter. Now, this court addressed that issue to some extent in the Samson case and talked about some ways that it might be addressed. We have to get that resolved, because until you do that, whatever you do with e-discovery is still going to require that data set be looked at in detail by people who are charging by the hour. and it's an enormous cost. When these publications say, and when the United States Supreme Court says that big companies are settling even anemic cases because of the cost of e-discovery, this is what they're talking about.
How does your proposal or the proposal by the Judicial Council reduce costs?
I don't see it. I don't think the proposals by the Judicial Council reduce costs.
How does your proposal?
Well,
how does the federal proposal reduce?
The mandatory meet and confer requirement with regard to ESI issues. Federal court has a mandatory meet and confer about broader issues, but having something that requires that the lawyers talk about whether there are ESI issues and whether there are ways to minimize the cost of dealing with ESI before you ever go and talk to the judge is a critical component. Why? Because very often lawyers aren't thinking about it at all until they get to the scheduling conference or just before the scheduling conference. The judges certainly aren't thinking about it in advance. They don't know anything about the case or the parties or the issues or anything else. So what you really need to do is you need to go to your client and say, what do you have that may be stored electronically? How big of a problem is this? We can have any legacy issue problems. What other kinds of problems do we have? And I, you know, I can give you a whole long list of 100 items you can ask your client about. And the other side needs to do the same. You need to come into a room and say, look, we've got a whole bunch of data in legacy systems. It's going to be very expensive. Let's talk about what you really need and how we can do this effectively. And if we disagree, then we talk to the judge. But if you raise that issue for the first time at the scheduling conference, what does the judge know about these systems? Nothing. What does this judge, who, as we've said, may not have seen a lot of e-discovery cases in his or her own career, what does that judge know about how to minimize these costs? Nothing. When one party says, this is an unreasonable, exorbitant cost, it's going to cost my client $100,000, most judges don't have Judge Sankovic's experience of teaching and talking about these issues and don't know. And so what you get is either, if you want it, then he gets it too, which may be totally inappropriate, a tit for tat. I'm going to treat everybody the same way. It's a very common response from judges in this state and others. And it's usually unfair and it's usually wrong. But they don't know. And they don't have a forum at a scheduling conference to deal with it. How much time do judges normally schedule for a typical civil scheduling conference? 15 minutes? Maybe a half an hour? You can't resolve these issues properly in that time frame. So what happens? The parties fight, the parties spend too much money, or you file a bunch of motions to compel. That is not a good allocation of either the individual resources or the judicial resources. Should the judge have to deal with this? One of my criticisms was that the whole scheduling conference list is permissive. You haven't really moved the ball because you've said you can talk about it, and as was said earlier, you've already got a catch-all provision. You can talk about whatever you want on a permissive basis. We need something that requires the lawyers to do this. We need something that requires them to talk about reducing the cost. And that goes into the whole discussion about forms of discovery and this whole issue about what form do I have to produce it in, what form can you ask it in, and how do we resolve that issue? We need better mechanisms, and I've suggested some.
Well, I'm going to ask you what they are, because how do we get around that you don't need a meet for an electronic discovery, ordinarily, in an eviction case, or in a... maybe a mortgage foreclosure. Maybe you do in a mortgage foreclosure, but you've got a ton of cases that don't need the meet and confer. You got some that do. How do you triage the cases so that you say, these don't need it, these do need it, and then you got some in the middle which you don't know. They may or may not.
I think you do it this way. I think you have a provision that says that if either party believes that electronic discovery is an issue that needs to be discussed, that it can demand a meet and confer prior to the scheduling conference with the judge. And you have to have one. And perhaps even a list of issues like cost control, limiting the scope of discovery, could be identified that must be discussed there. That way, if the lawyers get on the phone and say, Bob, you got any e-discovery issues in this case? No. How about you, John? No, me neither. You may be done. That's it. But if one of them says, I've got issues, or I think I may have issues with your side because of who you are and the nature of this case, all I have to do is send a letter and saying, I'm invoking my right to a meet and confer.
So it's a matter of lawyer advising.
Yes.
Then a non-mandatory is still okay. I mean, then it's up to the judge as to whether the judge wants it.
I think a rule that allows the parties to mandate it in a proper case is sufficient. The rule says if someone asks for it in writing, you have to have this, then you have to have it.
That's not what the federal rule says.
Federal rule does not say that.
Okay.
But the federal rule requires mandatory disclosures of information and mandatory meeting for about very broad subjects, which, by the way, if I were voting, I'd vote for it. I think it's a very valuable thing, particularly in the larger commercial case. I think that's all very valuable. The not
Milwaukee
reasonably...
Milwaukee still have a commercial court?
I'm sorry?
Does Milwaukee still have a, quote, commercial court?
Just,
yeah, that's what I thought, because no one...
Rules.
Right. that's why I asked the question, Judge. I know that there were rules designed to have emphasis placed on commercial litigation, and in effect, they were not, as far as I knew, used.
Your Honor, the language that was not adopted from Federal Rule 26B2B about not having a requirement of producing information which is not reasonably accessible is something that we need. Whether that is by way of commentary or by way of rule, I think ultimately doesn't matter. I think it's cleaner if it's in the rules. And again, I've given you proposals of language for those things. It all has to be cost-driven, because that's what is causing the problem now. Nobody disputes today, is electronically stored information discoverable? Now, we don't really need to add it to the list of things that are discoverable. Nobody contests that anymore, and maybe nobody ever did in any honest sort of way. But we do need help in controlling the cost of this discovery. The last thing that I proposed, and I did this knowing that this is almost certainly not going to happen now, but I'm hoping to get all of you to start, in the judicial conference, to start thinking about the next step. One of the problems with both the federal rules and the state rules right now is that they are not technology neutral. And so every time a new...
That's discussed, what was going to be my next question, at page 5 of your letter. Go ahead.
Every time a new technology is adopted, we changed the rule. So we went from phonographs to records to sound recordings. Why not list MPEGs and JPEGs and other forms of files? Why not list PDFs? Why not list .doc and .docs forms? Well, we've got all these things that somebody wanted to add at some point. The lists are not even consistent from rule to rule. And the reality is you don't need to list any of them at all. Why? Discovery is about finding two things, information and things. A document is a thing and it contains information. A car involved in an accident is a thing you may need to see. But all the rest is information, whether it's a sound recording, a photograph, or some other kind of image, a word processing document, or what have you. And if the rules everywhere were written to simply say, you have a duty to produce information and things in your possession or control that can be reasonably accessed, that are relevant to the subject matters that are discoverable under these rules, you would shorten all these rules by about 50%.
Well, is electronically stored information defined?
It is not defined.
Okay. Now, I think what you're objecting to, if I understand this, is proposed 804.091. Sub 1.
That's one example.
Which says writings, drawing, graphs, charts, blah, blah, blah. You don't think they need any of that?
No. In fact, data is electronic discovery.
Okay.
So it's already there in a sense. Data is not defined either. Data compilations originally came from an earlier version of the federal rules when there was a question about whether unstructured data compilations were documents, because the old rule was written in terms of production of documents. But this list is not quite the same as the other list that appears in another section of our rules. The feds have the same problem. Now, that's a major shift, and you may not be ready to do that now. That's not something that's been done anywhere else, although I do know that there are people at the Sedona Conference that are thinking about this. There are people at the Federal Judicial Conference who are thinking about how do we make these technology neutral so that you never have to change them again.
You ought to explain, it's been referred to a number of times, the Sedona Conference.
So Sedona Conference is a nonprofit organization that focuses on e-discovery issues. They have an executive director. They have a small staff. They have a number of committees. I think they're up to 8 or 10 now that deal with different aspects of electronic discovery. For example, one I've been active in deals with international issues related to electronic discovery.
They have a website.
They have a website. They hold conferences. They publish white papers. Those white papers are frequently cited by federal magistrates in particular when they make e-discovery decisions. They are all focused on the practicalities. How do we make this work better in practice? The volunteers that are on these committees are some of the most prominent big document litigators, if you will, in the country, from all across the country and some from Europe as well now. It's a very highly respected organization down in Sedona, Arizona.
Nice place to be, too.
In certain months of the year, yes. So I would simply encourage you to perhaps start a process looking toward the future. Whatever we do here now on an interim basis, whether it's adopting the federal rules, adopting part of the federal rules, doing something else, these rules really can be simplified. And by simplifying them, eliminate a lot of excess wordage, eliminate interpretive issues, etc.
But, counsel, when you do that,
go ahead.
You eliminate uniformity. You eliminate the ability, as was previously discussed, of a judge being able to go and find the federal rules, the decisions of the federal rules, and use that as guidance.
Yes and no.
Okay.
If there is a judge in Wisconsin who still needs to look up a federal case from the 1970s as to whether a data compilation is discoverable, yes. But I submit that doesn't happen anymore. If the question is, what are the most cost-effective ways to handle discovery of information and things, then much of what I propose would be to keep the federal procedural aspects, the clawbacks, the privilege situation with Federal Rule of Evidence 502, the meet and confer and what have you, and what is required there, what constitutes cost effective, when should cost shifting occur, those things would all be the same.
The same in terms of verbatim, the words are same in terms of concepts, but different words.
The concepts are the same, some different words, but mostly the same. Again, some of what I've proposed with regard to how the question of the form of electronic discovery should be decided are compilation of the federal rule, the commentaries to the federal rule, and some of the cases which now define what those mean. I've just put it there explicitly as to how it should work. I have not used the specific federal language because the federal language of who asks a question and who responds versus the state of Wisconsin language of what do we call somebody who asks a question and who responds, they're different. In fact, they're not even consistent within each set of rules. I've created a requester, a respondent kind of terminology. Yeah, there is an issue there. You would be out in front. You would be leading the way. I submit that's where others will go, and that's why I suggest you start that process early. There's one more aspect of the privilege rule that really needs to be on the table, and it is one of the things that causes most of the trouble still in the federal system. One of the things that Federal Rule of Evidence 502 does, and I'm going to paraphrase broadly, is it says if you've got a clawback agreement in this case, and the parties have agreed that if they inadvertently disclose something, the disclosing party can get it back, it's going to remain confidential, the privilege is going to remain intact, and then they went on and said, and that rule is going to apply in every other dispute in federal court and every other dispute between these parties. But they don't have the power to affect the next case between one of these parties, say the disclosing party, and a new litigant in a state court. From our perspective, the problem is this. Let's suppose I have a clawback agreement, binding contractual agreement. If I show it to you inadvertently, you have to tell me, you have to give it back, you can't use it. We all agree that there's been no waiver. If I get sued by somebody else and he serves a request for production of that disclosed document on me, under current jurisprudence, I've probably waived the privilege and cannot prevent its disclosure. So what do I have to do when I'm looking at the electronically stored information? I can get a clawback agreement with you, but does that protect my client against all claims of waiver? Definitely not. And if you happen to be somebody like Ford Motor Company that knows they're going to see more of these cases everywhere, picking on Ford for no particular reason, but that they do business in every jurisdiction, they have the same problem. To protect themselves, they still have to pay somebody to look at every single record. Or they've got to take the risk. And sometimes that risk looks good up front and looks really bad 2 years later. Sometimes you never hear from it again. The lawyers have to take the risk. So that issue needs to be resolved, and that's an evidentiary rule issue. The last evidentiary rule I raised, and again, this is not part of the current proposal, but it's part of the current problem, and that is there is an increasing body of law, and it arises mostly out of federal criminal cases, but it's seeping into the federal civil cases as well, where there is a question about whether an email sent between two employees constitutes a business record that falls within the hearsay exceptions for business records. It's a nice, interesting little dancing on the head of a pin question. When we look at it as lay people, I submit we would say, well, if it's written by two business people on the corporate machines about a business question, of course it's a business record. But technically it may not be. And so what amounts to correspondence between two people about an issue relevant to the case may not be admissible unless you bring somebody in to authenticate it. And that person may not be subject, particularly in state court, to subpoena. It may be too expensive, whereas in the federal system, you would have those problems because of nationwide service of process and some other things that they've done. We need to address that issue as part of the evidentiary issues pertaining to ESI as well. I've taken up a lot of time. I don't have any. I'm used to having green or red lights when I come here.
Well, we have few speakers, and so on a complicated subject, we're aware of the expertise of the various speakers and aware of our limited experience in it. So we're delighted, Mr. Foley, that you have taken the time and effort to write the court and to come here and educate us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
I don't know if this is a correct summary, but some of the concept I hear from you is that the petition is not as good as you might like it because it doesn't have some of these provisions that you've spoken about. That the court attempt to do something in the field is good and is needed, that anything the court does is a first step, not a last step, and it will have to be continually reviewed and will need to be modified.
I think that's a fair summary.
That's an important message. So thank you very much, Counsel.
May I ask you,
Justice Brasser,
did you have the opportunity, or what was the relationship between you and the Judicial Council Committee?
None, except that I knew some of the members. I read the report. I offered to do a Wisconsin Bar Association-sponsored program on these proposed rules, which I did on October 14th or so of last year. And at that time, Ms. Owens, who was there, approached me and asked if I would consider submitting something in response to the petition. As I said, I know some of the members of the Judicial Council personally. Did we talk about this at all?
We talked about it.
I think Bill and I talked about it very briefly about a month or so ago. And Judge Sankovic and I were at an INSA court meeting about a week or so ago in Milwaukee, where I talked about some of these issues as well. But otherwise, I have no relationship to it.
You're part of the Sedona Conference?
I am a member of the Sedona Conference.
Would it be fair to say that you're sort of a spokesperson for their viewpoint?
Not at all.
No. Okay, that wouldn't be.
That would be like saying I'm a spokesperson for the views of the Wisconsin Bar Association on this subject because I'm a member of the Bar Association. No, I think that would be going way too far, Your Honor.
Would you say that your views on this would be well received, by and large, by the members of the Sedona Conference?
It's always hard to know what's in the mind of other human beings, but I would expect that what the views I've expressed are consistent with what they are saying in their written publications. I can tell you about one other project that I've suggested to them and that I and some of their directors are talking about. Again, this is long-term and sort of background information only, but the problem with the attorney-client privilege is one that is usually dealt with in the federal courts after somebody's gotten into trouble. There's a magistrate judge out in Maryland who has decided that lawyers are not competent to develop adequate keyword searches for attorney-client privilege reviews and therefore must hire a computer forensic expert or a linguist in every case in which there is an ESI issue, that they have to have a clawback agreement, that it has to have certain things in it, and this is even before Rule 502 was amended. And that decision arose in a case where the lawyers got 10,000 documents, additional documents from their client the night before their discovery responses were due. They'd already gotten extensions. They knew they weren't going to get another one. They knew they were in trouble if they didn't produce everything. They just produced them. And, of course, there was privileged material in them. So the judge lambasted them publicly for not having reviewed them. I wouldn't want to be in their shoes when my malpractice carrier calls and says, your client's complaining because the judge said you should have done this. Was it practical? I don't think so. Was that the right decision? I don't think so. Is it the decision people face all the time? Yeah. Now, usually it's not 10,000 documents you got the night before, but it might be 100,000 documents you got 10 days or 15 days before discovery response is due. We're dealing with physical impossibilities. Well, practically they are physical impossibilities in some of these cases. Is it every case? No, absolutely not. But are there cases like this, and are some of them in the Wisconsin courts? Absolutely. Absolutely. I have settled cases for out-of-state business clients brought against them or threatened against them in Wisconsin simply because the cost of complying with expected e-discovery would be more than was being demanded. Too costly, period.
Throw this monkey wrench in, but e-discovery costs are really just part of the larger cost issues of litigating in this state. So one of the things that raised a flag for me is the issue of how a judge or how the court system can help reduce the costs goes much further than e-discovery. And that's why I raised the issue with you. How do you do it here?
One issue I didn't come back to, Your Honor, was what do I think about that you asked me? Was what do I think about the special master concept here?
That just increases the cost. You don't have to pay anything for the judge. I mean, you already paid for it in your taxes.
Right.
You put on a special master, you're now paying for it.
That just increases the cost again.
Right, it increases the cost. My experience with special masters in both state and federal court is that it is an inelegant solution to a problem. You go through first the process of, it's like selecting an arbitrator. Who are we going to pick to do this? And the parties are scared to death that someone is going to be appointed who the judge knows, but from the litigant's perspective is not fully competent to do it, is biased against one kind of a party or another, or against one kind of a solution or another, or they simply don't know this person and therefore they're worried. There's no track record of what this person has decided.
No predictability.
No predictability whatsoever. Very often, not just in the ESI context, but judges will say, well, I think I need a special master or a referee or someone, you know, an expert witness here. And the process of getting suggestions and vetting them and getting everyone to agree that we're going to proceed with this person can take weeks. You may not have that time. Sometimes judges simply appoint the people they know. It makes sense. I know this lawyer. I think he's done some ESI cases. Let's appoint him. Or maybe it's Bill. I know the book. You know, that's great marketing for Bill. That works. But speaking as someone who represents litigants in the trenches, we're usually not happy with the people that are selected because there is no predictability. We don't know them.
Rather take your chance with the judge.
We'd rather take the chance with the judge. My suggestion is better than that, better than either of those, would be to have a limited number of individuals who serve that function,
the
either
expert,
by a judicial district or if the caseload is small.
Expert list concept.
Yes. To have,
it's used in other circumstances.
Yes. Yes. To have the ESI magistrate or two for the state of Wisconsin to whom issues will be referred. They will make those decisions. They will publish something so we develop some precedent about what they're doing in terms of cost containment and decisions about what's an adequate keyword search and discovery. So that there is some predictability.
Mr. Foley, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been very helpful. Attorney Timothy Edwards. Mr. Edwards submitted written materials, and they're in the court's materials under tab 17. Morning. Yes, it's still morning. Good morning, Mr. Edwards.
Good morning, Your Honor. Good morning, members of the court. My name is Tim Edwards. I'm a partner at Axley Brennelson, right across the street here, and have brought two of my other partners with me, Mr. Mike Modell and Mr. John Mippy. Mr. Modell is the leader of our litigation practice group, and Mr. Mippy is our managing partner. Both have worked with me on the submission that we've prepared and have been involved in our observation of this process as it moves along. Before I go into any detail, I've never met anybody from the Judicial Council until today, and I've spent a lot of time reading what they've done and critiquing what they've done, but I most of all want to thank them for what they've done. I think the work that they've done is terrific. It's easier to critique than it is to create, and I understand the amount of time and effort that must have gone into what they have put together. 6 years ago, as we've already discussed today, this court recognized what was kind of looming with respect to issues surrounding e-discovery, and since then, as we all know, the federal rules of civil procedure have been amended to address some of those concerns. In the meantime, I want to share with you as a litigation attorney who practices in state and federal court what I've seen, what we've seen, and what some of our concerns are from that perspective and from that vantage point. We are seeing that electronic discovery issues are often a very big part of the cases that we litigate in federal court. But we are seeing more and more cases involving electronic discovery in state court. both commercial cases and employment cases are often document intensive with a plaintiff that may be looking for a number of documents, and often the fight in those cases is about emails. Mm-hmm. I want to emphasize that we've litigated these cases from both the standpoint of the plaintiff and the standpoint of the defendant. We're not aligned with any particular side of the V here, but we do have some thoughts that we'd like to share with you, and I hope that they can assist in this process, which we believe is so important. I'm a fan of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. I'm going to kind of put that out there. I think that there are a lot of good things about them. I think that the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure are important as a template for what we do because they are interconnected. They are thought through. You don't just pick one and leave the other behind. And I think it's a dangerous thing to do. And that's one of my concerns about this proposal, is that we've decided to pick some small parts of the work that the drafters of the federal rules decided to do, but leave the others behind, and perhaps forgetting in the process that they were all drafted together for a specific uniform purpose. In the middle of all of that, we are looking at this, trying to identify the areas that can be improved from, I think, two or three particular points of view. One is the management of the litigation. How do you manage a case? And we're thinking there from the standpoint of a trial court judge, and I don't have that experience. Cost. Mr. Foley just addressed that issue directly, and I agree with what he said. I think he had some very sharp observations. Fairness is another question. And how do you balance all of these three factors as you try to put together and implement a set of rules that govern this highly technical world that is very difficult to understand? I don't profess to have all of the necessary understanding of the technical pieces of this. I may have to borrow that book if you ask a tough question. But in the middle of all of this, I do appreciate that it is something that you can understand, that you can grasp, and that you can figure out to some extent. And I think it's going to be a big part of what some lawyers and some judges are going to just have to do. We have identified, I think, three or four areas that are points of concern for us in connection with the proposed amendments. And I'd like to talk about those very briefly. The first is the meet and confer process that has already been addressed. The second is cost shifting, which has been addressed somewhat. Issues surrounding privilege, and then this question regarding a mediator or a special master, and how that plays into this process. I'll start with the meet and confer process. Under the proposed amendment, the language encourages the trial court to get involved and to raise the question if that becomes necessary. Under the federal rules, it's more of a directive. So it's you can versus you shall. That's really the difference between the two, if you break it down to brass tacks. In terms of providing for an option for a meet and confer process, we don't believe that that is sufficient. And frankly, we believe that the rule already provides for that option in its catch-all provision, which kind of allows the court to do what it needs to do, and that would certainly include addressing e-discovery issues. I think that's a missed opportunity in an important way. The e-discovery process is different than the type of discovery that we're used to. Getting our hands on the contract documents, finding the insurance policy, maybe the car that's part of the accident that was referred to earlier. All of that is part of what we do and is part of what lawyers have done for years. But this is much different because it can be very, very complicated and it can be very, very technical. And the cost exposure to both parties can be exceedingly high. And because of that, having somebody step in at the early stage and to encourage cooperation and transparency is critical in cases that involve a significant amount of ESI. And in fact, I was looking around, and the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals has a pilot program regarding e-discovery. You may have that in your materials. You may note that
we have
the
reference to it, yes.
Right. The first provision that they have created, that they've drafted, relates to cooperation. In the Sedona conference is putting out information about how critical cooperation is with respect to e-discovery. And it's a difficult process because ultimately what happens is that the producing party at the front end may have to provide information about the technology that it uses, about steps that it took to preserve information that could be relevant. And that's antithetical to what we're used to doing as litigators because we typically hold our cards until we have to give them up. All right. In this situation, the meet and confer process actually, I believe, saves time, saves money, and I think it gets everything out on the table, if it's done right, in a way that issues for the court are clearly identified and the parties can separate out what's in dispute and what's not in dispute.
Counsel, if it's done right, give me the contours of what you're suggesting. If I recall in your letter, you gave some broader strokes with regard to this meet and confer issue,
right.
Talking about costs, talking about you've got to get in there early and the judge has to be involved. But one of the criticisms of the meet and confer and the feds is that it pertains to all cases, not just e-discovery. How do you propose that we should deal with that, if at all? And what kind of mechanisms do you propose to have it done right?
It's an excellent question. How it's done right, at least the meet and confer process, is going to depend on how cooperative and transparent the parties are. Let's put that to the side for a second. But what do we do about the fact that this is a mandatory process and that you'll have cases that are involved in this mandatory process that really don't belong there because the stakes are lower or something along those lines? Let me address the second issue first, because I think that can be handled either through what Mr. Foley suggested, which is that this can be a process that the parties decide to or request in order to move forward. In other words, somebody sends a letter saying, I have invoked this provision of the rule and we must meet and confer because there are e-discovery issues. And that would be a result of a discussion that they had up front. That's one possibility. The other possibility is that the court, when it sends out its initial pre-trial scheduling order at the very beginning of the case, could indicate that the case itself is exempt from the initial meet and confer requirement. I believe that would be one way to do it. Other than that, I would submit that if there is a meet and confer requirement that even applies to the smaller case, that the meet and confer process would be short and simple and really wouldn't be that significant of a burden to the parties and may actually produce some benefit.
Why don't the current rules adequately address your concerns? That apparently they don't, but let me ask. You folks are all pretty sophisticated people. You're not talking about a hit and run. You're not talking about a slip and fall here, generally speaking. You're talking about more complex litigation. What keeps you from calling someone and saying, hey, let's talk about it? And if they say no, what keeps you from making a motion to the court to compel it? And you can already do that. Why is that not enough?
I think we need to have a more formal mechanism in place with more teeth that gets parties to the table on these issues. The reason that I say that is because of the cost and because of the burden and because of ultimately the difficulty in managing a case involving electronic discovery, where it's really a piece of the discovery process, over time, in the absence of some upfront dialogue between the clients, the parties on each side, that address some of the questions that can come up. You had asked me earlier what would be a perfect meet and confer. Mm-hmm. How would that work, so to speak? And there are a number of issues that the parties can address that can help them avoid problems down the road. And I think this is where the cost savings comes in, and I think this is where some of the efficiency comes in that's so important. One of them is, and I think this is something that the federal courts are starting to address, is to have the parties sit down and openly discuss what their electronic architecture looks like. What do you have? Where are the possible sources of data? Things along those lines. In more sophisticated situations, that could involve exchanging documents that provide information about sources of data. The next thing then would be to talk about what steps have been made by the responding party to preserve electronically stored information that would be relevant to the case, and to see whether there are any problems there. And if there is a problem there, to nip it in the bud if you can. The big issue at these meet and confer sessions is often the form of production. And you see a reference to the form of production issue probably in every submission that you've received, because it's so central to the e-discovery and the back and forth and the cost. And ultimately, that's a perfect opportunity to talk about how these documents are being preserved, how they can be produced, and how they can be produced in a cost-effective fashion. Other questions about the accessibility of the data can come up, and then finally the scope of the search that may be involved. You can have a discussion about whether or not you're going to go into a huge database and query it with search terms, or you can have an opportunity to decide together that you will be searching emails on a custodian-by-custodian basis, as opposed to going through the whole set of emails that the producing party has. These are things that save a lot of time. These are things that save a lot of money. And at the front end of the case, if they are accomplished, I think they avoid a significant trouble that can come up later.
Your response has convinced me that there's a lot to be discussed and a lot of important things to be discussed. My inquiry in part is not whether those items that you listed should be discussed or shouldn't be discussed, but rather how do we get to the discussion? Should it be mandatory, a mandatory early confer, or should it be initially voluntary? Let me, and I really appreciate your response because it's teaching me a lot of things, but why can't it be you call someone and say, we've got all these things, let's talk about it. And if they say no, you know, forget it, why can't you file a motion to ask for a mandatory meet and confer prior to the scheduling order or the scheduling conference? Those tools already exist, and then either way, whether it's voluntary, yeah, let's get together and talk about this, or no, and as a result of an order entered that there be one prior to the scheduling conference, both ways the same things can be talked about. I mean, tell me why what I'm exploring isn't practical or won't work.
One reason is that some parties may not know that there is an e-discovery issue until they actually have the meet and confer. In other words, there are questions asked, there is a back and forth process that goes on, and you identify something that nobody had really thought about. That's one thing, particularly with the fact that everybody's trying to catch up on the learning curve with the e-discovery right now. And I think that's one answer. The other, you know, I think is a question of what type of a message you want the rule to send. And that's certainly not a question that I have the authority to answer. I could tell you if I had a vote, it would be thou shalt. I think it should be required.
But thou shalt really to the lawyers or to the judge. Is that what you're concerned about? The judge doesn't know he's supposed to do it?
I think that this is a two-part process. I think at the beginning, the thou shalt applies to the parties. They have to meet and confer. And then at the scheduling conference, that there should be some directive to the judge to address these issues and some guidance given. You had mentioned earlier about an educational function that these rules could serve and how that could be helpful. I frankly think that the amendments to the federal rules of civil procedure are in part designed to be educational because of the difficult subject matter. And if you read the commentaries to the rules, they really lay things out and kind of provide guidance for what should be done. But as far as whether you have to do it or whether you pick up the phone, I can only give you my personal reaction to that because I've seen how beneficial this process can be at the front end.
Counselor, doesn't part of making it discretionary depend upon two lawyers who are both sophisticated enough to notice one another and also cooperation? I mean, sometimes you're involved in litigation with a lawyer who is very cooperative, very straight up, and sometimes you're involved with a lawyer who is not. And if it's mandatory, then you do have to get together and you do have to address the issues. Where if it's cooperative and you call that lawyer and said, I don't want to talk about this, I'm too busy right now, then you got to make a motion to the judge and you got to prove to the judge why you need to have this discovery. So to me, that's just an escalation of cause.
That could be true. And the fact of the matter is that the federal system, and I think across the board throughout the states, there is a problem in terms of how lawyers are cooperating on these questions. The most recent material that I read from the Sedona conference really highlighted that and said that if the lawyers are going to be obstructionist in this process, it's not going to work.
And that's true even if you have mandatory meet and confer, because if they're obstructionist to begin with, don't even answer your phone or won't talk to you, there's going to be obstruction all the way down the line, or the chances are high.
Right.
Isn't that true in
the
practice?
Yes.
And that's what I hear at these conferences.
Right. And as an attorney on the other side of that, you document that, keep an eye on it, and at the appropriate time bring it to the court's attention. But it gives you an opportunity to create that record.
I'm hesitant to have a mandatory meet and confer conference for every civil case that's filed in the state of Wisconsin, because I think that's extra cost, waste of time. So how do you identify the cases that need it? Maybe you say all cases should, but that just doesn't ring for me. If, sitting as a circuit court judge in Wausau, most of the civil cases that I had certainly were not e-discovery cases, and I would hate to put on an unfunded mandate that's really useless. So how do you define that? If you came in here earlier and said, it's all complex litigation, I'd say, ooh, sounds like it's right. But no, you come in here and say, it's the mom and pop age discrimination case too, right? It's the, it can be certain products liability cases or it's certain cases not. I would submit that I can envision scenarios where it might be it could be a run-of-the-mill slip and fall case that was a national corporation and you want to know about policies and stuff. So how do you, if you're, number one, are you in favor of it for all civil cases filed in the state? And if so, why? Why am I wrong? And number two, if not, how do you identify which cases are going to involve electronic discovery issues that should be subject to mandatory meet and confer?
Thank you. I think with respect to your first question, identifying when or what cases are required for a mandatory meet and confer would be very, very difficult. And the questions actually kind of blend together. And I am for a mandatory meet and confer. The reason why is because I think that in the electronic discovery context, it's extremely helpful. We'll put that over here. It may be that other parties will have to meet and confer, even though there's no electronic discovery involved in their case. Well, I would submit that the meet and confer process there would still be beneficial, quite frankly. And as I alluded to earlier, it would be an opportunity for the parties to determine whether they had e-discovery issues and didn't even know it. But I agree with you, it's a mandate.
What about a $9,000 breach of contract case? You were going to sell me some item, maybe a nice boat and a used boat and blah, blah. Should I have them meet and confer? I mean, or a collection case for $6,000? The hospital is suing some patient for $6,000. Do they have a requirement to meet and confer?
It would seem to me that the court would be able to exempt certain cases that would not require that burden. But in my world, I still don't see that as being a huge problem, because I envision a meet and confer in a case like that to be 5 minutes on the telephone, identifying what kind of discovery we need to exchange, when the date will be.
There's no such thing as a five-minute phone call.
Yeah, between lawyers, that's
point what? And then preparation, point what? And then memo to the file, point what? Right?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
No, that is a true
point. I
don't mean
it quite like that. I am a little frustrated and trying to find the right answer, I guess, yes.
Mm-hmm. In the federal system, parties give the court certain information, like what stock holding, what corporations are involved, so that the judge can tell whether she has to recuse themselves, and other information. Does any of that information relate to whether there's e-discovery and that you need to meet and confer in the federal? You know what sheet I'm talking about?
What's that?
Do you know what information I'm talking
right,
about?
Right, in the federal system where you make that disclosure?
Right. Do they disclose there this is an e-discovery case or this is a...
No.
Something, okay.
No.
All right.
They disclose the type of case that it is.
Right, but not discovery.
Right.
Okay. The rule is never stand between the court and lunch. So let's see if we can wind up. I don't want to cut you short because I've not cut other people short. So I want to know what other points you want to make before we break for lunch.
Your Honor, I believe that those points are set forth in our letter.
Okay.
And I want to thank the court for its time this morning.
All right. Well, I'm going to ask you a final question anyway if I remember your letter, and I've read a lot of materials today. Again, the impression I got is that we should go closer to the federal rules, not adopt them verbatim.
Correct.
Would that be a correct summary of your position?
That's correct.
All right. Thank you.
I have one question.
Sorry,
Counselor Grogan, before you disappear. Attorney Foley raised the concern about clawback, and your letter talked about clawback too and said that you thought it was important that we put it in there. And I understand it from a cost perspective why it's helpful. He raised a concern that it may not be helpful with serial litigation. In other words, you and I could have a clawback agreement for this case, but if somebody else sues you on something else where this information would be useful, our clawback agreement really isn't going to have much effect. Do you have anything that you could comment about that concern that he raised?
No, I agree with the concern that he raised, and I think that it's important to make sure that every time you are involved in litigation to the extent possible to have a clawback agreement that goes beyond what's in the rule, if you can. That would be my recommendation.
Well, how could you draft a clawback agreement that's going to bind a party who's not a party to the agreement?
I don't think you can do that.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. I just thought it was a very interesting point.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Olson, would you prefer to speak now or wait until 1:30?
I wait until after lunch. I don't want to stand and wait.
Okay. we will return at 1:30. We'll hear Mr. Olson, and then we will go into our session of open administrative conference. I want to thank you all for coming. Is it, well, that's fine. Thank you. We are in recess till 1:30.